Hey, welcome back to Real Ramblin', and this is episode 10, going to be the final episode of season 1 of the podcast, and I'm so excited to be here with you all. Thanks for joining us, and John Ladd, thanks for joining me again for this last trip around the sun? I don't know, never mind.
If this was one episode a year, maybe, or...
Yeah.
But yeah, glad to be back, glad to finish this conversation.
Yeah, just to quickly recap, in episode 9, we started the journey of talking about and sharing thoughts on our top 5 favorite films of all time. This is like the holy grail of movie discussions. Mm-hmm. And in episode 9, we went through each of our number 5, our number 4, and our number 3. So this time around, we're going to mention some honorable mentions at the top here before we dive into number 2 and then the big one. Number 1 favorite movie of all time for each of us. And then we might, for a few minutes near the end, just to do something fun and different, look on, BuzzFeed or something and see what they've got for random movie trivia questions and see how we do. Maybe we'll do like best of 5 or something. I don't know.
I'm generally pretty bad at those.
Me too.
Yeah. Okay, that's good.
When I find that like you either get something that's too easy or way obscure out there, there's
totally
no like nice balance in the middle.
So. Yeah, it's either like who voiced Shrek or it's like... Who was the sound editor on Chinatown? It's like the show.
Yeah. We'll see what we get. It's going to be a mystery bag. All right. Honorable mentions. John, let's go ahead and start with your thoughts on this. What did not make your top 5 list, but you can't help but talk about it and show some love on it?
So these, my personal criteria for these was if we recorded this tomorrow, any one of these could have been in the top 5 and replaced any of my other top 5. Mm. So it's just kind of like they're that close to neck and neck. I have 3. Do you want me to just do all 3 of them right now?
Yeah, run through the gamut. Yeah.
So first is Patterson, directed by Jim Jarmusch, I think. I think it's how you say that name.
Okay, so not to be confused with Paddington.
Not Paddington.
Okay.
Though that would be also, that would be the 5th honorable mention maybe. That's nice. A great movie. Patterson, it's about a poet who... as a bus driver in New Jersey. His name is Patterson. He lives in Patterson, New Jersey, and he drives around. I would call it a plotless movie, much like Napoleon Dynamite, which was your number 5. Mm. And it's really, really, we've talked off mic about our frustration with kind of pointless movies or movies that are random for the sake of it. Mm. I wouldn't say this is random for the sake of it. I think it's really, in essence, it's a poetic movie. So it's a movie that is a poem in the way that poetry... So a lot of the poetry in Patterson is based off of the writings of William Carlos Williams. And it's just like one of his most famous poems is about eating a peach that his wife was saving. And he says he's sorry about it. Like that's the whole poem. So it's like, it's just whatever you need it to be. And it's about life and in very random sorts of ways. It's a great movie. Talk about great endings. Phenomenal ending on Patterson. Mm. And it's Adam Driver is the star. I love Adam Driver.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, he's great. Other one would be... I have 2. These are like, to me, antithetical movies of each other. They're similar eras, similar genres. One is Jaws. Definitely my favorite Spielberg movie. One of my favorite movies of all time. It is... If there could be a lesson from all of these, the lesson from Jaws is less is more... to the nth degree. So famously, they couldn't get their animatronic shark to work, and so he ends up in almost none of the scenes. they couldn't get him to look very good. So I and most people would posit that if the shark worked and they got him in the scenes, it would be a worse movie. Jaws is better because 1, you have that amazing score, 2, you have those great performances, and 3, you never see that dang shark until like the very, very end. And it's phenomenal for it. So Jaws all over is written. Less is more. It's a tight movie. Almost all my favorite movies are smaller in scale. Love, love, love Jaws. The antithesis to that, in my opinion, is Aliens. Aliens. Okay. It's funny that it's not in the top 5 because it almost was number 1. Like Aliens,
wow.
Depending on the day you ask me, is the greatest movie ever made. And it is big. That's a huge movie.
Ridley Scott.
Yeah, Ridley Scott. I mean, he shows you the alien all the time. Because Alien 1, obviously, is kind of the shark's mentality. Aliens is a different mentality. That's like, mm-hmm. Aliens to me is like the highest possible quality of like a Fast and Furious mentality, where it's just like bigger, faster, louder. But they crush
it. Works.
It works so well. I didn't see that until this year, and I was so blown away. I've been wanting to see it forever. Alien is another one of my top ones. And I was like, one of my hotter takes is that Terminator 1 is actually much better than Terminator 2, in my opinion.
Whoa.
Terminator 2 is the more acclaimed. I love Terminator 1. I think Terminator 2 loses a lot of what Terminator 1 had as far as identity. And I'd heard that it's also Ridley Scott. I'd heard that Alien Aliens was kind of similar. James Cameron is what I meant, not Ridley Scott. Terminator.
Yes.
And he did Aliens when Ridley Scott did Alien. So I'd heard Aliens to Alien was similar to Terminator 2 to 1. And in my opinion, they execute way better in Aliens because it still maintains the horror identity. It's still a very scary movie. They just are able to completely crank up all the numbers. The pacing is impeccable in the theatrical cut. There are other cuts and you get more in some of the other ones, but I think they screw up the pacing a little bit. So I prefer the theatrical. And again, all my favorite movies have terrific endings. The Aliens ending is so crazy and so over the top, but they pull it off. It's still believable. I can't talk enough about Aliens. That's a great movie. So
that's awesome.
To me, that and Jaws are like two sides of the same coin. One is as small and lean as you can go, and one is about as big as you can go while still being terrific.
I love that contrast that you laid out. Yeah. And you clearly did your homework on Aliens. I think I've watched each of them once, maybe.
Man, I would rewatch Aliens. I had rewatched The Thing earlier in the year, and I love
that one.
I liked it a lot. I was disappointed with how it held up a little bit. It's still what's that special effects artist's name with Cronin? I think Cronenberg.
I don't know the name, but I love the product.
I think it's Cronenberg who does just the really nasty body horror stuff like The Fly.
But cheesy because of the time that it was.
Yeah. And so I was a little bummed, and it was way lower budget, The Thing, than I thought it was, which is not a problem. I like a lot of low budget movies. But Aliens, going into that, I was like, well, what if I'm a little let down like The Thing? No way at all. Aliens blew all my expectations out of the water. And I knew it was a lot of people's favorite movies. So I can't talk enough about that movie. I'm surprised it's not in the top five. But it's going to beat Children of Men? There's no way. That's a 10 out of 10.
It's a tough choice. This is why we said at the top of last episode, like, we hate this question, actually.
Right.
As much as we love movies, it's so hard to narrow down to what is your top five, let alone like top three.
Yeah. I think I get more excited because it's so big, but I can't even say it's better than Jaws, because Jaws to me is a perfect movie also.
Mm.
So I think the reason we hate the question is because there are so many quote unquote perfect movies. So it's tough because I love talking about this, but it's definitely kind of like choose your favorite kid kind of thing, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah. Oh, that's a good analogy. Yeah. I can't do it. I, by the way, I don't believe that there's a perfect movie.
I agree.
I believe in near perfect movies.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there's any such thing as perfection in most spheres, but you know, people call Die Hard a perfect movie or something. Like for me, it's movies that I look at it and I go, would I change anything? Probably not.
Mm, yeah.
But that doesn't make it perfect. It means it's just better than almost anything that I've, you know, seen.
Makes sense.
I want to hear your honorable mentions.
Yeah, what didn't make my top five list? Okay, first one at the top of my honorable mentions list has to be Hook.
Ooh, great choice.
Yeah, I can't. I think I've said this five times already in the podcast, and I can't emphasize it enough. I am a product of the 1990s. I wear it proud, and so does Hook. If you think of like
absolutely.
What was the movie from the 90s, it's Hook.
Yeah.
I can't say enough about just how memorable this movie was to like me personally. It was another one that my family and I watched to death and mm-hmm. quoted to death. And for good reason, again, I think, because yes, it's a fun movie for kids, but like it's fun for adults as well. Even watching it today, some might say it doesn't hold up as much, or the acting was cheesy, or it is very dated. It's very 90s. But like for me, that's what I love about
it. That's the point. It's a, yeah.
But not only that, it does have some impressive just general audiences like, oh, that looks amazing, or oh, the sound quality in the score and everything like that is really good.
Yeah.
Robin Williams,
great,
obviously.
Yeah.
Like
Robin Williams, it gets plus 30 points just for having Robin Williams, and not any performance either. He's great in that movie. It's like You either get, Morg from Gorg or whatever, Robin Williams, or you get like Insomnia Robin Williams.
Right.
But Hook is both. He does the dramatic, like washed up old guy and the goofy kid. It's the like, I think it's like the buffet bar Robin Williams performance. I think it's great in that movie.
It's like everything else in the movie, well balanced. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dustin Hoffman. Oh.
Yeah. Dante Bosco, I think is his name. Rufio.
Yep.
Rufio's great.
Mm-hmm.
I love that movie.
And then I'll just go the obvious route here for the last of my honorable mention list and just mention Star Wars.
Sure. The first one specifically, or?
Actually, yeah, if you want, I did write down like my favorite of each trilogy, I guess. And the reason no Star Wars made my top five list is it's kind of just like, how can you? It seems unfair.
Yeah.
I've talked about this before. Like, it's so expansive and it continues to grow, which I love that about it. It brings new generations in to love it and all that. But that's why, like, I can't just say, oh, this one is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah.
But within the trilogies, so if we talk prequels first, Revenge of the Sith is my favorite.
Sure.
The lightsaber duel alone near the end of the film is probably the main reason for me. It is my favorite lightsaber duel out of all of the Star Wars movies.
Okay.
The original trilogy, Empire Strikes Back. Sorry to be so cliche.
I know, but I felt the same way. I was like, it's really just that good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's my favorite fight is in Empire, Luke and Vader on Bespin.
Oh, yeah.
It's so good.
Although I would say real quick, like if you could take the throne room scene of Return of the Jedi and make more of that as the movie of Return of the Jedi, that would probably take the cake for me over Empire, but
yeah,
because there's just really good like theme and emotional stuff there, but
it's great.
The rest of it is just kind of a fun movie.
Return of the Jedi, I think, gets a lot of flack because it's the weakest of the original trilogy, but it's still, I mean, it's still incredible. I remember rewatching it thinking, I thought this movie was worse. And every time I watch it, I think this movie's better than I thought it was every time. So it's like every time I watch it, it gets better. I don't know. I love Return of the Jedi also.
Yeah. But Empire for me is my favorite out of the original trilogy. And then for sequel trilogy, The Force Awakens. I honestly, for these three, and say what you want about any one of them, but they're pretty even for me in terms of like, I liked some things about them and I didn't like some things about each of them.
Sure.
But I guess it just comes down to the memories of The Force Awakens and the feeling that I got sitting in the theater again in 2015, the Star Wars title sequence.
So surreal. And
popping up on the theater and the smile I remember going across my face that stayed there for the whole film. It was like you said, it was an experience.
It didn't sink in for me until the crawl started. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is a new crawl.
Yeah.
This is a new text crawl.
Like, yeah, it's back.
I couldn't believe it. It was a really weird feeling. I've talked before, one of my more controversial picks is I love The Last Jedi. It almost made my honorable mention. So within that high of a thing. But again, I couldn't say it's better than Empire. I just love it so much. And that's one where, similar to Return of the Jedi, is every time I watch it, I love it more. And I understand very much. I understand a lot of the frustrations people had with it.
Sure.
But that's a good movie, in my opinion.
I agree. All right. So how about we dive into our number two and our number one favorite movies of all time? I'll go ahead and start so that we will end on you. My number two favorite movie of all time is The Last Samurai.
With Tom Cruise?
With Tom Cruise. That's right.
That's more surprising than Tron Legacy. To me.
Nice. I'm pleased with that. Yeah, I'm dropping bombs left and right on you, John.
No, that's big. That's, yeah.
So yeah, Last Samurai, Tom Cruise, 2003. I did not watch The Last Samurai in theaters, but I do remember the trailer. Again,
sure.
Trailers have always had a big impact on me. Even like before and after, I would say, the internet like explodes now of the tiniest little teaser trailer. Trailers are useful for me. So I don't like judge a movie completely based on a trailer when I watch it, but it is like, if you can cut a good trailer and deliver to the audiences before the movie even comes out, what the movie's going to be about, what it's going to look like, what the feel is, then that's where you're going to draw in at least half of your audience. Right.
Sure.
And I'm one of those people. So I remember the trailer, and I recall literally, I recall scoffing when I saw Tom Cruise in the full like samurai getup.
Right.
So I admit there was some like early kind of doubt there. It's like, oh, here we go. Now he's a samurai.
Yeah.
Like he's everything. And as a general rule of thumb, I am not a fan of Tom Cruise. So this choice almost surprises myself. But again, it speaks to how amazing I feel this movie is. This movie became the exception for me with Tom Cruise, a lot like how Interstellar was like my, okay, now I'm a fan of McConaughey.
Mm-hmm.
When I finally watched the movie on cable television, roughly 5 years after it came out, and the story progressed to the third act in which he does put on that armor, I did not scoff. It was more like a fist pumping moment with man tears streaming down my face, right? Like, I was ready for it. And I kind of attribute that change of heart to, again, acting. I talk about casting a lot, but strong acting and story, of course, but also to the fact that the storytellers, John Logan and Edward Zwick, they took their time telling the story. So this is roughly a 2.5 hour film, which feels perfect to me. It doesn't drag.
Sure.
And on the other side, like it doesn't feel rushed either. You have Hans Zimmer at the helm for music, never a bad call, as we talked about.
Yeah.
Excellent supporting cast. And I love that the majority of the supporting cast were either like Japanese or Japanese American.
Mm-hmm.
And each of them acted their hearts out to the point of almost like outshining Tom Cruise in many scenes.
Sure.
And I'm glad, by the way, I like that. Because I don't think this was supposed to be, nor should it have been, the Tom Cruise show.
Right.
It was about his character, ultimately. It wasn't about his character.
Mm.
It was more about an entire nation, like, struggling with its identity. And so credit again to the storytellers for doing some homework, because this was one of the big draws for me as a social studies teacher, as someone who gets into history. Like, it's another reason why I love The Last Samurai. It's a good historical fiction. And some people I've talked to say, no, it's not. But I'm like, how can you say that when, like, okay, I've studied and taught a large portion of Japan's timeline and their history, and primarily from Japan's feudal medieval period up to the 20th century with the world wars, Japan did go through a lot of change. Mm. And a big segment of that was featured in this, call it silly if you want, but like historical fiction movie with Tom Cruise.
With kind of
it.
That like isolationism versus
not isolationism, yeah. Westernize, don't westernize, Shinto or Buddhism, or let people decide their own path, militarize with technology or not. Mm-hmm. A lot of that was featured well in this movie. So I love that. And it's, I think a lot of that comes to a culmination in the climax of the movie as well. This is one of my favorite, like, third acts of any movie, and I think that's why it's on number 2 of my list.
Sure.
It's heartbreaking, and it captures like the history of it at the same time. So if you remember, you've seen the movie?
Uh-huh. Yeah. I think now it's been, I feel like I watched it just recently, but now it's been probably 5 years. And honestly, the third act is mostly what I remember. I remember the introductory scene with him and who would eventually become like his friends. And then I remember the third act. So I'm hazy in the middle. To me, it feels almost like a montage, like a training montage, like in Rocky or something.
It is.
And then
it's an extended montage.
Yeah.
But I don't feel like it was cheesy or time wasted.
You needed it to really believe that they were actually like, that these characters had grown and loved each other and, you know. Yeah.
Exactly. Like I said, if you didn't have the middle meat of this movie, like I wouldn't have been like, all right, Tom Cruise is a samurai now.
Right. You just see him in that red armor and be like, what are you doing?
Yeah. But man, that last stand at the end of the movie where the Japanese army, and by the way, I don't care about giving spoilers.
Okay.
If you haven't seen this movie by now, like, come on.
Yeah.
Go watch it. Japanese army faces the last stand of the samurai, and they bring out this shiny new Gatling gun.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And so like the big gun comes out, and the irony is after half of the movie is spent showing the Japanese infantry, this was kind of their montage piece,
mm-hmm.
being trained with like American military tactics, both with rifles and hand-to-hand combat, all that. By the end, they simply like mow down the entire remaining rebellion with the turn of a crank. Mm-hmm. And that is just like, wow. It was a wow moment.
Yeah.
And as it's happening, the Japanese soldiers are visibly showing the pain and guilt that they feel. Some of them are crying even because, like, not only are they like taking the lives of their own people, but they're destroying a piece of their heritage.
Yeah. And that's, I love that. It's, they bring into plot the thematic battle of the whole story. So yeah, the whole story is tradition and progress. And so the turning point of the main conflict is progress defeating tradition. So yeah. I love that they, when the theme is that integrated into the actual guts of a story, that's a big win. That's great.
Yeah. It's just, it sticks in my mind.
Yeah.
Really.
I wish I had more to say about it, but again, I'm just hazier on the details. I remember equally, because you have like this kind of prototype of a story, like or prototypical story, like Pocahontas, Avatar,
yes,
Dances with Wolves.
I knew that was going to come up.
Yeah, and then Last Samurai. So it's almost like you have this thing, this outsider kind of thing, and even now maybe it's a little less politically correct. Even though I don't think it's, like you said, I think it's especially respectful. It's about as respectful as this movie can be of the culture itself. And of those movies, I don't think highly of Avatar. I like Dances with Wolves, but I think I think this executes everything it was going for about as well as it could have done it.
Yeah, I put it up against an Avatar or Pocahontas and proudly make a good contrast because it's not necessarily like one group versus another. It's almost like, again, like a cultural group against itself. And,
right.
And having like that internal struggle.
Yeah, that infighting with identity. And
yeah, and that's what makes it more intriguing to me.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's not just, like you said, it's not just colonialism versus, you know, like Dances with Wolves is very strictly, it's more, you know, an ethnic fight. It's an invading white force and a assaulted native force. So when you have the, like you said, both factions are Japanese, it's not like Tom Cruise fighting his, you know, own American army or whatever. I think that is more thematically interesting. And when the theme is identity, I think they, like you said, that's a stronger, more rich premise.
Yeah. And to be like, to give credit where credit is due as well, movies like Dances with Wolves, very well done. And that kind of story is important to tell as well.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I love The Last Samurai. That's my number two. How about you?
Okay. So my number two, real quick, I had two realizations while you were talking, and it was that, I forgot about the existence of three other movies. So I just want to say that I want to say their names just so I can
some more
rest
honorable
easy,
mentions,
but I will not dive deep into them for the sake of time and for my own sanity.
Okay.
And they are Fargo and the first two Spider-Man movies directed by Sam Raimi. I've talked about Spider-Man 2 before, so that one I'm good with. Fargo, I just wanted Coen Brothers on my list because I love them, and Fargo is my favorite of their movies, but I'll go on. So number two, those are just three very brief honorable mentions.
I was going to make a fart noise after you said Fargo, both with it sounding like fart and my opinion of it, but that's okay.
I guess it's a good thing we didn't have to delve deep on it then.
I still respect you, John.
I appreciate it. Number two, talk about long movies, is Blade Runner 2049.
Mm.
And among my friends, this is a contentious opinion. I don't know if it is in the broader circles, but I think 2049, similar to Aliens, smokes its predecessor. I like Ridley Scott. I love Blade Runner 1. I think it is, Blade Runner 1 is maybe a harder to read movie to its strengths. I mean, so rewatching it, you feel more contemplative. I think Blade Runner 2049 wears more of its themes on its sleeve. I think you watch that and by then you're like, I get what this is. And part of this is insane special effects. So when you were talking about Tron Legacy, I was thinking, I really wonder what Jeff Bridges looks like right now. I wonder if I wonder if it's challenging or not. But these special effects in 2049 are like truly, truly unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it in my life. And the pacing here, so we talked a lot about runtime. This has a close, probably about same as Interstellar's. And I remember first time in the theater, I saw this in theaters twice, and the first time in the theater, I feel like we're almost to the end. And then I think, wait, in the trailers, there's a whole nother location they go to that hasn't even shown up on screen yet. And truly, we were only 2/3 of the way through the movie.
Uh-huh.
And so normally this would be a detriment, but the movie just bounces. It just comes to what would have been a compelling close, and then basically launches into an entire another act that I've never seen anything like it. Normally when this happens, like in The Dark Knight, this is my big complaint of mine against The Dark Knight, is the movie has at least two, maybe three endings.
Yeah.
And it doesn't feel smooth. It feels janky. And 2049 has two endings, and it's smooth as butter. I think they nail it. It's less of two endings than it is a bait and switch, a misdirect.
Right.
So it's the illusion. If all movies are illusions, they really nail the illusion. And really, Ryan Gosling's another one, just amazing performer. I think he could be accused of maybe being a little more one note than a guy like McConaughey. Even though he has the all right, he really does. he diversifies. I don't know how much Gosling diversifies. Mm. But he's great in this movie with very subtle changes. And again, I will try and avoid spoilers, but if you know anything about Blade Runner, it's about robot humans, and it's a lot about what it means to be human. And so very, very small facial changes are very important. One favorite scene in the movie is a feedback or a baseline test for these androids to make sure that they are, you know, not feeling too much emotion. And so the baseline test differences as the movie goes on with Gosling's facial performance is honestly so impressive. But mostly it comes down to, again, I'm a sucker for theme. I recently read Stephen King's On Writing, and he downplays theme quite a bit. He says story always comes first. And I respect the opinion, but he says if you happen to find a theme in your story, that's good. But for me, if there's no theme, what's the point? Like, I want to learn something about the human condition.
Yep.
Blade Runner drips with it. Like, you know, you could say it's some kind of, like, revolution plot, like some kind of uprising plot. But really, it's all about what it means to be a human being. And excellent implementation of the original movie. It's so far removed time-wise. You have kind of a Star Wars dilemma where how much do you really, or a Tron dilemma, how much do you really, you know, have the audience rely on the audience to know the first movie.
Off-screen time passing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And I think they nail it with Harrison Ford. And I'm a sucker for, this will be a minor spoiler thematically, I'll allow it just because I want to talk about it. I'm a sucker for the, what I would call a John the Baptist archetype. Mm-hmm. So the archetype of not the chosen one. So you have, like in the Bible, obviously it's not a problem that John the Baptist is not the chosen one, but he is the one who comes before the big man.
Right.
And so the role of the support character, and how in scripture it's not tragic, but in a movie like Blade Runner, it's very tragic to think you are special and the one, and to not be the one. And they pull it off so well. Honestly, though, I'll keep going back to the well of style and substance, or writing and visuals and aesthetic. I think here, this is a merger. This is a marriage of the two that is almost unmatched. I rave about it a lot. But Denis Villeneuve, I don't know if I mentioned he directed this. Probably my favorite living director. Again, Prisoners would be one I would talk about. Arrival could be one I talk about. But Sicario, yep. I mean, he doesn't miss. But 2049 is, for me, a very special movie and bombed at the box office. I think it's, I don't know if it's a Blade Runner thing or not, because the first one did too.
I find that interesting, yeah.
But man, what a movie.
But both enjoyable films.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Real quick, I did want to ask, like, okay, in compared to the original, do you prefer 2049?
I do. Part of it, I think, is maybe the word would be cohesion. I feel like Blade Runner 1 has a lot of questions and less of a point. So it's still amazing. I love that movie. I think by comparing them and by saying which one I prefer, it sounds like I dislike the first one, and I love the first one. I think what the first one did for even just movies as a genre is huge. And, you know, you could go back before Blade Runner 1 and cite Akira, but it doesn't really matter because Blade Runner really nailed that exactly the same thing that it wanted to. If we're judging it on what it meant to do and what it did do, Blade Runner's a 10. Like, it did exactly what it meant to do. But I think if we're talking about cohesion of theme into plot, like I said, with Last Samurai, if you can immerse the message or the point, I guess the way to boil it down is the point. If you can tell me the point in the plot, if you can really, really pull off that kind of, what sort of, like, transcendence almost, that to me is like when you really, really hit the ball on the head. Like, that's the home run. So Blade Runner 1 is deep, it's thematic. Aesthetically, it's beautiful. Special effects are amazing still. Like that, I don't know if you remember the effect on Rachel's eyes. It's almost like that photography or like animal effect.
Yeah.
Still like unbelievably good look. Like it's crazy how well they nail it. And the score is amazing. But I think it succeeds less in the integration and the point than Blade Runner 2049 does. And again, pacing can't be said enough. I think Blade Runner 1 is smoother because it's a little shorter. But 2049 pulls off a trick that I've never seen a movie that has two endings actually do it well. Normally, that's a complaint of mine against a movie. Like I said, with Dark Knight, it's a point against it. With 49, it's a point for it, in my opinion. Have you seen it?
I have, yeah. Okay, yeah. And I was just thinking, like, I remember watching the original Blade Runner and not being able to get past the weird of it. But maybe that's because I was younger when I watched that one. But looking at both of them now, I think, again, you highlighted everything that's amazing about them. A lot of stuff, but music and aesthetic, like that's what sticks out to me with the
music
movies.
Man. Oh, and it's beyond music for me in 49 than it is sound design. So again, in theaters, this is a huge, if you're talking about the merits of theaters and home viewing, this in the theater was was unbelievable. Like there's a sequence, again, I'll keep talking about the endings till the day I die. The final sequence of this movie was so loud in a non-painful way, in a way that was immersive and just like chest shaking with the just the base of this scene, and it made it like a big moment. And I think again, just technology, they couldn't have pulled that off back in, I forget what year Blade Runner 1 even came out, but with what they had, the original Blade Runner has an amazing sound design also. I have that on vinyl actually. It's one of my only like maybe valuable possessions is the original Blade Runner score on vinyl.
Wow.
Close to when it came out.
I might have to steal that from
you. I know. Yeah. Hopefully no one robs my house now.
Yeah.
So number two or one for you? I already lost track. One, right?
Number one. Number one. We're already there. All right. My number one favorite movie of all time, to no one's surprise probably, would be The Lord of the Rings. And yes, I cheated.
Is this all?
I know it's a trilogy.
Dang it.
So if you're going to make me choose, I have that ready to go as well. But
we'll get there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. But let's just...
I will want to know, but I want to hear you. I want to hear your opening statements.
Okay, sure. And actually, for my opening statements and all my thoughts, I wrote down a few like bullet point notes for myself.
Sure.
Not necessarily to remember as much, but actually to contain myself and like not go on for another hour about The Lord of the Rings. Because it's come up several times now on this podcast, and each time I'm just like, yeah, I love it. It's good.
Yeah.
And so I would love to take that time to delve deep into...
It could probably be its own episode.
Oh, yeah. And it probably will be. But for now, let me give you that bullet point list. So book to film, that is so good that I like the films better. And I talked about this with Vicky when we did the book to film adaptation episodes.
Sure.
I will admit that in most cases with book to film, the book is more quality, even if I would rather watch the movie for time's sake or whatever. But The Lord of the Rings is one of the exceptions for me that I say it was done so well, which, by the way, was like this at one point in time insurmountable task.
Right.
And not many people wanted to touch it. But credit to Peter Jackson for taking this on. And it became, in my opinion, better than its source material, even though I absolutely love the source material to death. And I could read those books, and I do read the books about once every year. But the movies, okay.
Man, this is my Fargo for you.
Okay.
I love the books, and I love the first movie. The first movie is on my list of the greatest of all time. I've got some real beef with 2 and 3, only because of their divergence from the books. But I still do want to hear your notes.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Let's see. Peter Jackson did The Near Impossible. I did mention that, but worth mentioning again. Good job, Peter Jackson.
Yeah.
Not so much with the Hobbit trilogy.
In 3 years? Like, that's crazy. Back to back to back? Just unbelievable.
Yeah.
The undertaking is nuts.
The Lord of the Rings made me a super fan. This was like one of the first things growing up that we talked about fandoms earlier on the podcast. And like, this was something that I jumped into, and I was proud to call myself a nerd of Tolkien and Lord of the Rings and all that, to the point of literally like I was the kid and the young adult that had posters in my room. I had the memorabilia. I spent an entire semester even of my sixth grade science class instead of paying attention, drawing extremely detailed maps of Middle Earth, like in my notes.
Do you still have those?
I wish I did.
Ah, that'd be cool.
But yeah, Vicky knows about that and she makes fun of me for it. Like,
yeah, I bet.
But yeah, I did that because priorities, right?
So yeah, for sure. I'm with you.
The score, Howard Shore.
Oh, unbelievable.
It's cinematic, but immersed in fantasy, the score. So like, yes, it's grand and it's good. It's quality. I don't know if anyone would like discredit that. But like I mentioned with Tron Legacy, it immerses you immediately into that world. So absolutely. Like as soon as I hear a song come on the radio or someone's playing it on YouTube or whatever, again, I have to stop what I'm doing and I have to, if not watch the movie right then and there, say, okay, I'm penciling in like scheduling when I need to sit down and watch these movies again. That's how powerful the music is.
Man.
One of my best memories is having to do with that, putting on one of the three movies, doesn't matter which, in my college dorm room at night and, at like a good sweet spot, right? Like 9 PM, let's say.
Sure.
So that by the time the movie's ending and the credits are rolling, I'm feeling sleepy. It's much later and I'm now being whisked away to Middle Earth or Dreamland or heaven or whatever you
want. Yeah.
Just some of the most peaceful rest I ever got, like legitimately. I know that sounds funny, but this was my like psychological experiment that worked. I'm like, I never slept all that well in college.
Yeah.
And then I started doing that and it's crazy.
That even after like, Two Towers with like Helm's Deep, like even,
oh yeah,
like waist deep in orc guts. And you're just like,
yeah,
off to Sandland.
Yes. Well, like I said, most of the time it would be like in the final rolling credits that it
for
was
sure.
Just that sweet spot where I'm like, now I'm ready to just doze off and be at peace.
I love
like,
that.
Put a sword in my hands and
yeah.
Send me down the river. Cause
that's great. On your own. That was great storytelling. You put me in that headspace. I know exactly what you're talking about. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. And then finally, like, I like that the lore is deep, but not as wide sprawling as some of the other fandoms, like I said, or franchises like Star Wars and things like that. So I would say that I'm more deep rooted in the Lord of the Rings than I am in Star Wars. That's why this made my number one.
Totally.
And a Star Wars movie did not.
Well, you know, it's like you said, Star Wars is still expanding. Lord of the Rings is a little more locked down than Star Wars is.
Yes.
So I see what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and then, I could say a thousand more things, but I'll cut myself a little bit short here and give the rest of the time to you here. But if you're going to make me choose one out of the three, it has to be Fellowship of the Ring.
Gotta be. Yeah. Absolutely. I'm glad you said that.
Well, it's the most iconic and it's the origin, and I am a sucker for origin stories.
Mm-hmm.
And like just the exposition was brilliantly played out and directed. And
even when I was first reading Lord of the Rings, I was like pretty fed up with the Shire by the time they got out of there. But now, man, I'll take all the Shire you can give me. So like the first big chunk of the movie, absolutely. Like I want to live there forever.
Yeah.
So I'm with you on that. Do you ever watch just the theatrical cuts or are you exclusively extended now?
I'll go either way.
Okay.
Yeah.
I still haven't seen the theatricals. I've only seen the extended. But
really?
Yeah,
okay. I feel like that's the opposite of most people.
I know. I just watched them so late. At this point, all anybody ever talks about is the extended. So I was like, I might as well just go in, you know, both feet.
Full geek. Yeah.
Full geek. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And, oh, you do have to carve out a weekend if you're going to do that.
I know. It was funny because we watched one and two probably like a week apart. And then Return of the King, not until like a month later. Because my wife was always like, she loves these movies. She was like, we got to watch Return of the King. I was like, baby, it's a Tuesday. Like, there's no way. I can't swing the extended edition Return of the King on a Tuesday.
There's another one, by the way, that had like three endings.
Oh, yeah?
And mixed opinions.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
But I was all for it. Like, give me more.
I think it's an exception for me because it doesn't do it the way 2049 does it, where it is not the smoothest, but it is because it's so much a fairy tale. It's chapters in a book. You know, you say goodbye to all your friends individually. I think it works sequentially in Lord of the Rings, where you feel like you're winding down. Like you said, you're almost just going to bed, and you have to like knock off the list. It feels intentional to me. Where in a movie like The Dark Knight, I don't feel like they executed as well. Where this movie, you had to do that. It was such a journey. you know, at the end of the third right. part of the journey, you've got to wrap it. Like, you have to say bye to everybody, you know. I'm with you on that.
But I have heard plenty of people complain about that, about Return of the King. And I guess I could agree with them to a certain extent. Like, you're just getting ready to, I don't know, wrap up, or you're falling asleep yeah. in a good way, like maybe I was. And then all of a sudden, like, the Eagles are coming. And then you have, like, another half an hour. Like, okay.
Yeah. I guess I could see that. I don't know, because to me, like, if you have a problem with that, I don't know how much you really would like Lord of the Rings. Mm. Like, you know, the whole point of it is so, like, sentimental. It's almost, like, cloyingly sweet. And a lot of people with, like, modern storytelling sensibilities would be like, well, you know, about, like, the pure evil and pure good in the story. Like, well, it's not really compelling. I think that's kind of a wash. I think it is a fairy tale at its heart. Mm. And the epilogue of Return of the King, the book, talk about places you could live forever. That's like one of my happy, happy places is the epilogue of Return of the King. Just the way home, picking Bilbo back up or seeing him again, getting back in the Shire. The Scouring of the Shire, which isn't in the movie, is sad and brutal.
It's interesting.
That's a tough one.
I'm kind of glad that didn't make it into the theatrical cut of the
right,
movie.
Right, because it would have made, if there were complaints of the start and stopping of the ending, that would have made that even worse.
Yeah,
in the movie.
What, a C plot?
Right,
like
exactly.
Come on.
Exactly. But to me, for most people, again, of my friends, they would say Return of the King is the best. I think Fellowship, easy, the best, like easily. And again, all of my complaints with 2 and 3 come from thematic breaks from the source material. Not thematic breaks, but plot breaks. So like, when a Nazgul sees Frodo and Sam is Osgiliath in Return of the King, or in Two Towers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, whoa, dude. Like, that means Sauron knows they're, like, at the gates, or at the feet of you know, Mordor. Like, that's crazy to me. That's a huge, like, that's a lore inconsistency. But it's thematic for a movie, or it's dramatic, excuse me. I'm using that word too much. Dramatic for a movie. So I've got nerd nitpicks with it, because I very much prefer the book. But if you read it once a year, I don't need to sell you on the books. I mean, get it. Yeah,
I love them both.
Yeah,
but I know what you mean about the nitpicks. Like that's how I feel about the entire Hobbit trilogy, which I've talked about already. Like, okay, it's one thing to take a few creative liberties, but
sure.
This is like no longer the source material.
And the difference is that Fellowship, the movie, takes from the book. I think they. Rule. I think they crushed it with Fellowship, like with just exposition. So like all the front heavy exposition in the Fellowship novel, in, you know, in front of the fire in Bilbo's house, which is a really cozy scene, they break that up. So you get part of that same dialogue in the beginning of the Mines of Moria, right after they escape the squid monster. They're in the cave and camping the first night in there, and then they give a little more of that. So like stuff like that, sure, it's a divergence from like. From like the canonized book, but I think for a movie that was a great decision. So it's not every time they diverge that I have problems with it. It's just most of the time.
Sure, no, that's fair.
Is, I should have seen this coming because I know how big a fan you are.
Yeah,
that's a good choice.
Well, spotlight's back on you for your number one favorite movie of all time, John.
I know
no pressure.
You didn't do it on purpose, but just saying Spotlight again breaks my heart. That's not even in an honorable mention.
Oh.
Spotlight's a great movie. I love that movie.
I don't know if I've seen that, actually.
Oh, you totally should. It's that same, like I said, it's in that Zodiac kind of genre of trusting the audience.
Okay.
Really detail-focused, really, and I'm a sucker for journalism movies. All the King's Men.
You are a journalist, so that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And when I was doing my research for this episode, actually, I realized that, like, 2015 was an insane year for movies.
Oh, yeah.
2015 had Spotlight, 3 Billboards Outside Ewing, Missouri. It had The Revenant, another one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
It didn't have my number one. My number one came out in 2011. It is Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life.
Mm-hmm.
Abroad, I know this one not among my friends, because my friends haven't seen this, but I know in broader circles, it's a controversial movie. It received both standing applause and boos at the Cannes Festival when
at the same time
in the same showing when it was first showed. Terrence Malick's a weirdo. He so this movie, I'll get into what it's about first, I guess. This movie is about everything. It's kind of the problem. It's the smallest human moments and the cosmic realities of the universe. It's all at once, but it's mostly focused on a family in Texas. I think in the 70s, maybe the 50s. And it's about one of their children die. And so that kid's brother grows up. It's about the family. Casting, insane. You got Jessica Chastain, Sean Penn, Brad Pitt. They all crush
it. Heavy hitters.
Yeah. And Sean Penn has come out to say, and this is characteristic of Terrence Malick. Sean Penn has said that he filmed so much. He thought he was in like a normal movie. And the best way you could put it for Tree of Life is it's experimental. So like there's, I think maybe two shots in the whole movie where the character speaking is actually moving their mouth on camera. So like almost all of it is narration. And even if the character on screen is narrating, he won't be talking at that time. It's just showing them. So maybe a handful of times they're actually talking on screen. So it's a very experimentally done movie, but it, to me, there's really with the scope of it. So like I said, most of my favorite movies are smaller and leaner. The reason this is this is my favorite of all time is because the scope is gargantuan. So the opening scene of the movie is two dinosaurs fighting in prehistoric times. And then it cuts to, you know, there's shots of just the cosmos just interspliced into the middle of like the movie, just like giant nebulas. And then you have scenes of two brothers, you know, in like grade school running around in Texas in like the woods, you know, hitting each other with sticks. And so it undertakes, you know, insane themes. And the scope of it is so grand. And I think the only way that you could have done it any justice anyway is this experimental kind of tone. And when I first watched this, I watched this very soon after watching 2001 A Space Odyssey, which I love. And the whole time I'm like, this is, to me, a spiritual sequel to 2001 A Space Odyssey. Mm. And later I found out that they hired the same special effects guy. The same guy who did 2001 did it. So they have the same one visual feel. But two, they undertake a lot of the same things. This one is much more concerned with grief. And probably the majority of the questions that it's asking or the universal themes it's exploring are grief and time. 2001 is less concerned with... This is a human 2001, I guess is how I'd say it. If 2001 is about... It is a little less breathing. 2001 is a little more... non-ironically, it is more robotic. It's a little more, you know, scientific or clean.
Right.
This is a much messier, equally grand movie. I prefer it to 2001. It is less plotted. And so the frustrations people have with it, I totally understand. Again, Sean Penn was not thrilled with it because he was, I don't know if I finished my thought, but he was in enough scenes to be a normal movie. He thought he had a script that was like a normal movie that he was the main character of. And that's just not the movie that happened, that came out. So I don't like, know.
What is this?
Yeah. So I don't know where that stuff went. Hmm. It's a heck of a thing. And again, understandably controversial just because it is, it's unconventional. And I think a lot of times I have frustrations with unconventional movies. It might be controversial to say I don't like David Lynch very much.
How dare you?
I know. But this one, because I think a lot of movies I grade, well, one, to be my favorite of all time, it just plain blew me away. Like on an emotional level, I can't always really explain, you know, why it did or didn't do that. But on a critical level,
I would hope that it made you feel something.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. On a critical level, I think, again, a lot of what it set out to do and what it did do. And I think to do what this movie does, you have to just let go of a lot of stuff. If this was a movie about Sean Penn going about his business, you couldn't ask the questions this movie asks. Mm. It wouldn't be possible. And I think, and if you could, it wouldn't have been nearly as impactful. You've been to the EMP Sci-Fi Museum or the MoPop now?
Yep.
And you see a prop in a movie you've seen and you go, wow, there it is. I walked out of this movie and I saw a tree and I went, whoa. A tree. This is no joke. This actually happened. I walked out, and like I was a character in a movie, I looked around. I stopped walking. I looked around. I just couldn't believe it. It was very much a weirdly, spiritual adjacent experience. Mm. And I can't give that to anybody. There's no telling if you watch this that you would have that same experience. So it's hard to say in that regard. But
I'll be honest. I have not seen this movie.
Yeah.
But with your description, it sounds like everything I love in sitting down and thinking about a movie. Maybe it's not a make some popcorn and turn my brain off, but sure. I think I would love this, so I'm definitely adding it to my must watch list.
Yeah, I can't recommend it enough. Again, it's one like I don't know, if I was at like a barbecue and we're talking about movies, I might not bring up Tree of Life. It's a little, you know, I would bring up Aliens way before, and I love Aliens again, or even Blade Runner, but it's an odd thing. And it's, again, I wonder, when you're talking about criticism and the like art of criticism or the merits of criticism, I don't know where that comes into something that's as emotional as this. I think, you know, when the discussion of film as art, I don't think we've really gone there, at least not in this episode, but this is one where it definitely leans there in a similar way that Patterson does. I would say these are similar movies in their lack of structure. And if Patterson was to make a movie that is a poem, this is to make a movie that is, I don't know, an expression of grief or wonder. I'm a big fan.
So this is a testimony, you say, that lack of structure can work.
Can work,
and exactly. Sometimes it is about the artistic expression.
Exactly.
And it sounds like it gave you an experience almost, like you said, going out of the theater. It's like a spiritual sense of, maybe I'm incorrect in my parallels here, but like how I felt when I walked out of Truman Show. And that could be a funny like contrast.
That's on my list also. I love Truman Show.
It made me think on a strange level of, at least for a few days, like, is this actually what my life is? Like, yeah. I don't know. It gave me this like existential.
Yeah, I totally get it. Maybe this one was less, because the existential, you know, Truman Show question is maybe frightening. This one was more, I don't know, almost a sense of not really grief, just a renewed kind of sense of wonder about things.
Hmm.
But yeah, I have a lot of frustrations with intentional randomness or, you know, again, not necessarily exclusive to Lynch, but a lot of things that you would see like, wow, isn't this weird? Ooh, you know, and this one to me, so there is that means the pitfall of unconventional filmmaking or structureless filmmaking. And there's a lot of stuff that I just plain don't enjoy sitting through. And a lot of that, it just comes down to preference. So this to me is, with my, you know, buttons, this is the ultimate, well, maybe you could call it, in the things that I value, this would be the ultimate film, period. But definitely the ultimate unconventional film. But yeah. Hmm. The reason it goes on the top, and the reason I didn't have to, I was racking my brain for the rest, but the reason I didn't have to wonder about the top is because I've never seen anything like this movie, you know, and there's a lot of, I'll admit that I'm a very Western centric movie watcher. I haven't seen a ton of like, you know, indie international movies. There's probably a lot like this out there, but I know, Terrence Malick in general is this kind of guy. This wasn't necessarily a one-off, but I go on and on, but that's my number one.
I love that. And that's definitely a criteria. I feel like for anyone's favorite movies is like, have you ever seen anything like it? And I admit too, a lot of my list is very commonplace Western. Like you say, like people know about it.
It showed in a theater, you know, around the country.
Right. They're popular choices. Yeah. I'm okay with that, but I do love that you have, for your number one, maybe not as well known, but it's something like you've never seen before. And that's important.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome. All right. We say we do some trivia?
Yeah, for sure. Let's do it.
All right. All right. Here we go. I Googled movie trivia generator. Let's see what comes up.
Oh, good.
I said I kind of wanted to try BuzzFeed because oftentimes that's like...
They make a lot of those, I think.
Yeah, I've done like a Harry Potter type quiz on BuzzFeed. And let's see. Okay. How much random and basic knowledge do you have about popular movies? This quiz should be very, very easy for any cinephile. Uh-oh.
Oh, no.
Okay.
At least they're popular movies. Like I said, I'd hate to go too deep.
All right. And Back to the Future, what year does Marty McFly travel back in time to?
52? 1952?
Close.
Maybe just 50 even? 50?
Who out there knows it?
Come on, let's hear it.
It's 1955.
Ah, 55.
Yeah, yeah.
One person was screaming about it.
right. Yeah. It's 55. Come on, John. Yeah, let's calm down here. This is fun trivia. And that to me was like, okay, I know it, but some of these I know are going to be...
You knew it was 55?
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
In Clueless, number two, in Clueless, Cher was wearing a dress by which designer when she was held up? See, this is like the type of question you were talking about. Like,
yeah.
What? We go from Back to the Future, somewhat well-known theme element to, or a plot point to like, I don't know. I don't follow fashion as much in movies.
No, I'm
sorry.
Get, the only fashion designer I know by name is Tim Gunn.
Okay.
It was, or Yves Saint Laurent, I think is his name.
I'm not sure about this either, and I'm just going to click on one of the choices then. I'm going with Armani.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I know Armani. That'll work.
Okay, no, that was incorrect. It's Alaya. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly. I'm sorry, fashion people, fashionistas.
I don't know if anyone was screaming, it's Alaya.
It's, you idiot. Maybe, I don't know. All right, let's try a couple more. Do you know Coming to America pretty well?
I know of it. I've never seen it, actually.
Okay. Yeah, we can skip that one. That's fine. You might. Okay. In Coming to America, Prince Akeem and Semi take jobs working at a knockoff of which company?
I do not know.
Walmart, McDonald's, Chuck E. Cheese, or Blockbuster Video?
I'm going to guess Blockbuster. Or Chuck E. Cheese. Is it Blockbuster?
No. It's McDonald's.
Dang it. Neither of them.
That one I knew, but again, these are like hit or miss. I don't... Okay. Oh, this is pretty good. Where did Kevin's family travel to in Home Alone, number one?
France.
Okay, I'm clicking on Paris. That was one of the options, and you are correct.
Sweet.
I'm telling you right now, like, I got that incorrect. I was thinking Florida. Is
oh,
that
really?
Number two, where they end up, like, stuck in Florida?
No.
And it's raining?
They're in New York. Well, he's in New York,
right.
Number two.
And then I think they're in Florida, maybe?
Maybe.
Okay.
I can't quite
it's
remember.
Been a while.
Yeah.
Those are definitely on my rewatch list,
yeah.
Especially coming up to Christmas time. Do we want to? Okay, let's do one more.
Let's do it. Yeah.
Okay.
Better be good.
I'm trying to find like a. All right, this is one where we both really enjoy the source material.
Ooh.
Movies are hit or miss depending on the installment. Okay, what is the name of Jeff Goldblum's character in Jurassic Park?
Oh no.
You got this, John. Come on.
Duncan?
No.
Oh. If it's not Duncan, I don't know.
All right, I'll give you...
He's just
some...
Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park.
Well, and the funny thing is, like, one of my favorite characters in the book, but vastly different than how he was portrayed
sure.
by Goldblum, so
yeah.
It's like he can't really go off of, oh, come on, you know from the book.
Yeah.
So the choices are Dr. Elliot Grant, Dr. Max Donner, Dr. Ari Richards, and Dr. Ian Malcolm.
Malcolm, that's what it is.
It is Malcolm, yeah.
Duncan Malcolm, whatever.
All
right. I said Jaws is my favorite Spielberg movie. It is, that is true still. I think it just edges out Jurassic Park. I do love Jurassic Park.
Okay.
For similar reasons, I mean, just the what you do and don't see. So like the rippling water cup before you actually see.
Oh yeah.
You know, any of the T-Rex, you do see way more of them than you see of the shark and Jaws. But yeah, great movie.
Good stuff. Thanks for joining me on that adventure of trivia. I would say we, I don't know, let's give both of us a B on that, a solid B.
I,
yeah.
I don't regret not knowing who the designer of the Clueless dress was. So, yeah, I'll give myself a B. I'll take that.
Nice. And, yeah, John, thanks for having this discussion with me, going through our top five favorite movies of all time. It was challenging. It was exciting, intriguing. I'll never forget it.
I'll be with you the rest of your life.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm glad that I have some more movies to add to my watch list moving forward that I haven't seen before. And then definitely listeners, I always say this, but continue watching movies, both your favorites and maybe even movies that you don't like as much. Give them a rewatch and think about maybe other perspectives on them. How would you feel differently if you gave it a rewatch? And then, of course, like John and I are going to do moving forward, go and watch some of those movies that you have not seen before, and then we can always come back and talk about them. And let me know. Reach out to me, RealRamblin@RamblinReal on all the social media platforms, and then please continue listening to the podcast. I super appreciate your listenership. But this has been a really fun season one. It's been an adventure for me, kind of getting out of my comfort zone in some ways a little bit, just doing the podcasting thing, never done it before. But, you know, it was summertime and I had the time, and I'm definitely glad I embarked on this and looking forward to many more episodes to come. Season two may not come on to the airwaves for a little while. As we speak, we're looking September in the face right now, and the autumn breeze is here, which is awesome in some ways, but you know, it's also back to work time for me.
Sure.
And so I'll probably take a little bit of a pause, maybe in about a month or so, come October, we'll have season two. Season two will come in with a bang.
Yeah. Awesome.
And John, always great to have you on here.
Great to be here. I don't talk this much. My voice is a little hoarse after all the ranting and raving. But
yeah, all the rambling. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All the real rambling. But it's always just a good time to talk about things you love. One last thing I'll say is Westerns were not represented on my honorable mentions or my top movies.
Mm.
And it's funny because it is one of my favorite genres. So if I were to have some kind of shout out this episode, it would be to go watch for a few dollars more the second movie of the Dollar Trilogy.
Okay.
It's my favorite Western movie. I have different favorite Western books. But that would be, if I'm having a shout out this episode, that's what it is this episode.
Awesome.
So just because I wouldn't be able to sleep at night if I was like, I didn't mention a single Western on the whole freaking thing.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't have any Westerns on mine either, and I do enjoy the Western genre.
It's tough.
So I'm going to sneak in a shout out as
do
well.
Do it, yeah, please.
Almost to counter yours.
Okay.
I love Clint Eastwood. I love that trilogy. But my shout out is, everyone, go back and watch Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and please, someone tell me, who is the good? Because they all kind of seem bad watching it now as an adult.
Yeah.
Like, okay, Clint Eastwood, it says he's the good, but he's like,
he's a pretty bad dude.
He's shooting guys left and right.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I don't know. They're called revisionist Westerns, but there's no white hat guy in those movies. They're all pretty grimy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still, that graveyard scene. Oh man.
It's pretty great.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Thanks for joining us on the journey, and we'll see you next time. Keep on rambling. Thank you.